You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's episode is sponsored by civic engagement podcast Future Hindsight, who are back with an all-new season on systemic racism in the U.S. Each week, they'll explore how the legacy of slavery still permeates our country and how we can rectify it. This week, they're taking a look at racial bias in organized labor and the shocking wage gap felt by women and people of color. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts. Now, for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, New York Times cybersecurity reporter Nicole Perloff. In her book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. Also on the program today, yesterday was day one of impeachment, and Trump's lawyers made the case that Trump can't hire good lawyers. And today, as the trial will continue, day two of impeachment, House managers will show security cam footage to drive home the costs of Trump's incitement. Meanwhile, COVID infections down, but mutant COVID looms. As data shows, bans on evictions are curbing COVID spread. Joe Biden signals his support for the House COVID checks threshold, meaning those checks are going to go to the same people as they did last time. 11.5 million workers face unemployment insurance cliff starting in 4 weeks, so the Democrats got to get busy. Chicago strikes a deal with teachers to finally give them COVID protections that they needed on day one. CENTCOM says it will continue to help the Saudis and hope they don't kill too many Yemeni civilians. In the wake of a coup in Myanmar, police fire into protests, and the U.S. announces it will not drop its case seeking extradition of Julian Assange from the U.K. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. It is day two of the impeachment hearings. Those hearings start in a little bit from now. And in day one, of course, they had essentially one vote. And that vote was whether a former president can be impeached. And that vote turned out it wasn't a there was a little bit of a surprise, wasn't there? Emma Vigeland, who is joining me today, as always.
You got my name right. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yes. Nailed it.
How are you today, Sam?
I am well. There was one surprise, right? Like, we knew, based upon a vote that took place, I guess it was a week and a half ago now. Time has flattened for me. Rand Paul basically introduced a motion to summarily dismiss the case because ostensibly, there was no constitutional grounding for impeaching a former president. At that time, five Republicans voted against Rand Paul. All you needed, you really didn't need any, right? It's 51 vote. The vice president could have voted. This time, they basically took the same vote, but it was 56. Or I should say there was one more Republican who voted in favor of the idea that it's constitutional to try a president who's been impeached.
Yeah, and
or a former president.
Well, it was Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, and his reasoning was basically Trump's lawyers are so bad that they're forcing me to vote that this is a legitimate constitutional trial. Doubt he will actually vote to convict, but that's just a little preview of how horrific Trump's lawyers' performances were yesterday.
It was stunning, to say the least. And on some level, not surprising. I mean, he fired his first set of lawyers a couple of weeks ago. And then, you know, I mean, everybody's been in this predicament, right? Like, you know, you've got maybe your tub is backed up. And so you call a plumber, but the plumber calls and says, I've got mono. I've got mononucleosis. I can't come.
Right.
Do you know another plumber? I don't really. Well, I'm going to call my cousin and see. And they just go, oh, yeah, no, I've done some plumbing. And then they come over and that's what happens.
Well, I mean, one of the people on this team was a personal injury attorney who has sued him in the past year. So that's just the kind of folk that Trump had to resort to.
There,
team of rivals.
Exactly. But here, so look, there's a lot of footage we could show you, and we're going to play that clip from Cassidy later, but there's a lot of footage I could show you to explicate just how bad Trump's, never mind the case in and of itself, which I think is a pretty weak case, but just how bad his attorneys are. But we've settled on two. And the first one, they're both from Sean Hannity's show, and Sean Hannity is interviewing one of the attorneys on the team, not the worst one, although that attorney seems to be like they're in almost like in a race to see who can do a worse job. They are talking about Bruce Castor, and Hannity is begging this guy to fire Bruce Castor because of how poorly he did. Here's Sean Hannity with David Schoen.
To drain the swamp, whatever they call it on his side, to make a difference in this country. That's what political speech is about.
There's a lot of criticism of the opening, not your part in particular, but it seemed to be free associating, extemporaneous, somewhat meandering. Will the rest of this process, because you're going to be out, as I understand it, Friday and Saturday, Will this be more focused and will it be more prepared? And are there other people that are planning to make those arguments? Because some conservatives called me and said, well, we need somebody harder hitting here.
Well, the fellow who you say did the opening today has his law firm there. They seem to be very capable people. I'm sure today he hadn't planned on going. And so I'm sure that they'll be very well prepared in the future and do a great job in the case. There's a lot to say, and I know they feel very strongly about fighting against what they're seeing.
All right, David, good job today. Thank you so much.
I'll tell you something. First off, he doesn't even say his name. Like, as if, like, to be honest with you, I wasn't even familiar with him.
Yeah.
Did they just admit that their lawyer didn't realize that he was going to be speaking today? That doesn't seem like they've prepped very well. It really does have that sense of, like, I know a guy, he's not quite licensed, but he could come over and fix your
Yeah,
he does
a little bit of everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's plumbing, right? Yeah, well, I mean, he does electrical sometimes, but I'm sure it can't. How different can it be?
It's all stuff within the walls.
So that gives you a sense of just how bad everybody, and what they're trying to do, of course, is set this up of like, oh, it's not Trump's fault. Trump has a great case. It's just they don't have a good lawyer. But then watch what the good lawyer, David Schoen, does afterwards. Remember, the case is, did what Donald Trump say incite his supporters? Right? That's the case. And here is David Schoen maybe accidentally making the case that, yes, he did.
Have to say they deserve impeachment.
Yeah, I would say if they tried to impeach them, I would say that also was an abuse of the impeachment process. But your point is they're using rhetoric that's just as inflammatory or more so.
I'm sorry. The point here is they are now trying to make the argument that Democrats have said just as inciting things as Donald Trump did in that speech leading people in. So here.
was an abuse of the impeachment process. But your point is they're using rhetoric that's just as inflammatory or more so. The problem is they don't really have followers. You know, they're dedicated followers. And so, you know, when they give their speeches. But this speech, I think right now you really are finding out about the pre-planning. And I'm afraid they're going to back off that investigation because maybe, you know, so many people want to tie it to Donald Trump. There's nothing they showed today that in any way ties this to Donald Trump. It's just a silly argument. It's not tied to Donald Trump.
Okay. Now, did you catch what he said there? Democrats have said the exact same thing. It's just the problem is they don't have those type of dedicated followers.
They don't lead the cult of personality, and that's on them.
But what does he mean by the problem? What he means by the problem is their failure to incite their followers to go commit an act of violence like this is because they don't have they haven't really done the work and laid the ground to have the proper followers. When he says the problem, he is saying the reason why other people haven't done this. And what is the this? The this is incite other people to violence. Look, the bottom line is I can take a match and I can drop it in a bucket of water and nothing happens. But if I take a match and I decide to drop it in a bucket of kerosene, and that's what Donald Trump did. For years, he has been basically filling that bucket with kerosene, creating the fumes. I know it's not a perfect analogy.
All right.
And he lit the match and threw it into that kerosene. He knew what he was doing. Everybody else did. And there's his attorney just basically admitting it.
Yeah, I mean, there's two prongs of what they're trying to argue, and they're doing it pretty poorly. One is that he didn't incite it, which his lawyer just admitted to, basically tacitly, on Sean Hannity's program. And the second is that you can't impeach him when he's not in office, which, as Jamie Raskin and the Democrats have pointed out, is patently absurd because it sets a precedent that a president can do whatever they want in January, do whatever they want in the final weeks of their presidency, and there are zero consequences. The case is insanely weak, but Trump will still get off because of the partisan nature of all of this.
That's true. But that first part that you're talking about in terms of whether he can be impeached has already been adjudicated, essentially, by
this
jury. And that was yesterday. And today, it'll be interesting to see if we see Caster. I suspect we may not.
I mean, this might have been a plea to get him fired, Sean Hannity trying to communicate with him via the TV, as he so often tries to do.
It was reported that Donald Trump was rather unhappy with Caster's performance. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Nicole Perloff. She is New York Times cybersecurity reporter on her book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, the cyber weapons arms race. We'll be right back after this. Folks, we have some sponsors of today's show. As you know, I mean, for a lot of people, you've avoided to see the doctor with good reason. You've avoided going to the dentist. There's a lot of different things that you've avoided because of COVID. Well, after a while, everybody, I would imagine, has something they should be seeing a doctor about. If making a doctor appointment seems like a chore or it's causing you anxiety, well, PlushCare is here for you. They make it super easy to schedule an appointment and see a doctor so you can prioritize your health hassle-free. PlushCare provides virtual doctor appointments through your smartphone or your computer. All you got to do is you pick a time that works for you. You book an appointment online. There's no waiting on hold, no sitting in a crowded waiting room, no travel. With PlushCare, you can be diagnosed, treated, and even have a prescription sent to your pharmacy of choice within minutes. PlushCare accepts most major insurance carriers. It's available in all 50 states. And if you're having difficulty managing your emotions, PlushCare has doctors available to help with that as well. I mean, look, there's nagging little things that you got going on, maybe things that you're a little worried about that you want to make sure aren't anything more serious. Telemedicine is a great option to deal with those things, deal with the anxieties maybe building because you haven't addressed them in any way. PlushCare makes it easier than ever to take care of yourself inside and out. You can start your membership today. You go to plushcare.com/majority. Start your free 30-day trial. That's PlushCare, PlushCare.com/majority for a 30-day trial. PlushCare.com/majority. Also, Valentine's Day is only days away now. And obviously, maybe a little bit tricky to have a special Valentine's Day. Well, I've got an idea for you. Now, I don't know if you can get it in time because we're only 4 days away. But nothing like showing a, you know, I've done this many times where I get a gift and I've been a little bit late. So I print out a picture of what the gift looks like.
Classic.
Well, Hunt a Killer is the murder mystery subscription box that is the most exciting date night you can do at home. It's a great, I think it's a great Valentine's Day gift. Hunt a Killer brings people together, challenges them to decode ciphers, examine evidence, solve puzzles. With each delivery, you'll sift through documents, evidence, audio recordings, and case files. You eliminate suspects, you identify murder weapons, you crack a case, you catch the killer. That's basically what you do. You can enjoy your favorite beverage during it. I mean, it's fun. You can also do it with socially distant friends. Plus, there's an online community where you can get all sorts of helps. It's a spoiler-free thing, so everybody knows not to tell who the killer is. But there's thousands of members. They help each other solve difficult puzzles. They talk about true crime. Also, part of the proceeds of every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation, an organization dedicated to helping with real-life cold cases. My case, I've been playing with my kid. She's into these type of things. I don't know if she really knew it. She was just told me that she really likes Law and Order. And I was like, would you like to actually like try and solve one? And she was super psyched. And it is amazing to have your kid be into anything that doesn't involve a screen, at least in my household.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why I think it's a good Valentine's thing is if your relationship is a little bit rocky, you get into, this is like a mini commitment. It's like a trial run. Like, you know, because, I mean, you can speed up your boxes. You can get them to send it to you quicker, but otherwise it's once a month.
It's right?
And then you're basically locked in for 6 months.
It's a good idea. It's
like you're not going to leave a relationship when you have a case active.
That's right. It's like having, it's like, you know, people stay together for the kids. Well, you get stay together, you get solve the case. I don't know. Matt, you've been doing it, right, for with your girlfriend?
Yeah, I've also been doing the Cadence Theater Hunt a Killer episode where you go over, like, yeah, they have, like, police documents and stuff like that. Like, what is the murder weapon? No, you have to email it with a secret code. So.
This is a, I guess, 90-year cold case? 1930s? Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. Cool era.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also been fun, too, because you get, I mean, in this instance, teaching my kid a little bit about, you know, not real history, but, you know, some, I guess, like an idea of what was going on at the time. Right now, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use promo code majority for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure you use the code majority. You get 20% off discount. The question is, do you have what it takes to hunt a killer? All of our coupon codes and whatnot will be in the podcast and YouTube subscription. You can find it there, obviously. Just a reminder, this program is supported in its large part, most part, 90, I don't know what the exact percentage is, 90, 92%, 95%. It changes month to month by our members. We can do this because of our members. If you want to join the show, support the free half, also get the first half commercial free, go to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, and we give you extra content every day. So check that out.
And like the stream.
Oh, and like the stream on YouTube. And also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 20% off. I got slammed on Twitter by a big name
skeptic.
I don't know. He was critic. Upset that I was he was attempting to make I guess to mock me because I support just coffee, and it's been a boon.
Although I saw other replies where it was like, he said, Sam's not the worst person on the internet, which I think is like the closest you're going to get from
him.
You
should blurb that.
I should. Yeah. I am not the worst person on the internet.
If you ever write a book, that's your next quote.
All right. Well, I'm going to, that'll be my jacket cover. Speaking of books, I'd like to welcome to the program Nicole Perloff. She is the New York Times cybersecurity reporter. And off of This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, the cyber weapons arms race. Nicole is just about joining us via Zoom. Nicole, are you there? Almost, folks.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear
you. See me?
Now we can
see you. You're sideways. That's odd.
Sideways. Okay. Better?
There you go. That's great. Nicole, thanks for joining us. This is obviously well-timed, and we will get to this, but there was a fairly scary hack just the other day, or reported, in Florida. We will we'll get to that. I want to put that in context. But let's just start with the title. This is how they tell me the world ends. Is it that serious?
Well, the title came because, you know, when I started covering this 10 years ago, people were always warning me of a devastating cyber attack that was going to hit the grid or our water or railways. And I kept asking them, like, okay, so when is this attack going to happen? And they always had the same answer, which was 18 to 24 months. And now we're about 10 years past that point, and we haven't had that calamitous attack. But through my reporting, I've just realized we are inching very, very close to that. And the attack that you mentioned last Friday in Florida is a really good example of a very close call. So we're getting there. I wrote the book to make this my own left moment where I can really lay out what the vulnerabilities are, what the threats look like, and what it will take to lock up these systems.
All right. Well, let's start with this concept of 0 days or O days, I guess it is. What is that? Nicole, you there?
There you are. Okay. Sorry. Switched internet. Okay. I'm back.
Okay. So what is explain to us what this concept of 0 days or O days is.
So 0 day is just an undiscovered flaw in software that is not known to the software manufacturer. So, you know, when you think about the software updates that you get to your phone, that means the software maker, let's just say Apple, is fixing some bugs that was found in its software, and it's rolling out a patch so that your phone is protected and your communications are protected. But in the hands of a hacker, those same bugs and flaws, and unknown to manufacturer 0 days, could be used for more nefarious things. Like they could be used to spy on your communications, and there's a real government market for these 0 days.
And we should say 0 days refers to specifically how urgent a fix this is needed, right? I mean, I guess theoretically there are, you know, problems you have with the software where it's like, we should get around to this because it's inconvenient for people, or we should get around to this because when you do this, it freezes up. But when we refer to something that's 0 days, it's something like, this is crucial and urgent that we fix immediately because it has a massive vulnerability.
That's right. Usually the bugs that we call 0 days are pretty critical. They could be used for everything from espionage to surveillance to a more deadly attack if it's in an industrial control. So, you know, it got its name because once discovered, people have had 0 hours to fix it. But I actually like to think of it more like patient zero in an epidemic. Like once you find that infected person, you need to come up with a vaccine, you need to immunize them, and you need to make sure you're immunizing everyone else so they're not infected by the virus. And that's essentially what a 0 day is in the digital world.
All right, so let's go back to when we started, or I should say in your sort of journey of understanding exactly how wide or big the vulnerabilities are and what the threats are. This was it basically was Snowden's revelations. Is that right? Tell us what did Snowden tell us and what did he not tell us in terms of what you ultimately found?
Well, I was brought into one of the Snowden projects and was given access to some of those leaks. And having covered cybersecurity for a few years before that, I'd always heard these murmurings of a gray market or a black market for zero days. And so once I was glimpsing through the Snowden documents, you know, if you looked at any of those documents, they were really vague. They were always out of context. They were PowerPoint slides or memos. But there were these vague references to pretty much a backdoor in every technology that you or I rely on for our daily lives. Everything from your iPhone and Android to firewalls, routers, switches. So there were references in the documents to commercial partners and their security partners and third parties that were providing them with some access to these backdoors. But the Snowden documents never explained that in any detail. And if you remember back to 2013, really the outrage was on things about the metadata collection program that the NSA was doing, and also the phone call, you know, tracking people's phone calls and understanding who they were calling and when. But to me, the bigger revelation that seemed very unexplained and sort of intangible and hard for people to understand was the fact that, okay, we know that the government probes software, okay? We know that they use this for espionage. We know because there was a crazy masterpiece of an attack that the U.S. pulled off with Israel against Iran back in 2007, where they took out their uranium centrifuges with code. We know that these have real battlefield implications. And what I wanted to know is there a market for these tools? Is the government paying hackers for these zero days? And what is the moral hazard there? You know, if it used to be that we spied on Russian technology and they spied on American technology, but now we're all using Windows, iPhones, and Android phones. So if the government finds a zero day in Android software and they decide to keep it because they want to spy on terrorists or our adversaries abroad, that entails a trade-off, which means leaving Americans more insecure. And the reason that the stakes are getting higher there is that other governments, after that attack that we pulled off in Iran, their eyes have been opened to the potential of a zero day, both for espionage and for destruction. And so they're all looking and hoarding these same vulnerabilities. And in the end, it sort of leaves all of us less safe. And then there's another caveat here, which is we're rolling all of that vulnerable software into our critical infrastructure, into our water treatment facilities, into our power plants, into transportation, into airplanes, into fighter jets. So there's no slowing that down. You know, we're just at the beginning of our virtualization with AI and everything. So I wanted to have this conversation now to say, do we really want to be leaving all of these systems and software more vulnerable so that we can preserve our espionage advantage? Or do we want to stop and say it's time to lock up these systems?
Okay, and the Iran attack you were talking about is Stuxnet, and I want to circle back to that. But this concept of the market and how it developed is fascinating to me. So, like, walk us through the sort of the mechanics of it. The national security apparatus. I mean, I guess this starts even, you know, decades ago and to some extent, right? But where did the first market come from? Was it coming from Microsoft saying, like, hey, there's some you know, quasi black hat hackers out there, and maybe we can have them inside the tent pissing out as opposed to outside the tent pissing in, as they say, right? To make sure that we're not subject to their vulnerability, so we're gonna, you know, seek these people out, or that mutated into, we're going to throw a bunch of cash out there and see what it attracts. I mean, how did it develop?
So it's a little bit different, which is, and it's really interesting. You know, I quote the Lonesome Dove in the book where it says, I think we spend our best years fighting on the wrong side, because in the 90s and even in the early 2000s, when hackers, and, you know, I use the term hacker loosely, but it's basically just someone, like, it could be a good guy, a bad guy, a curious guy who's probing this software. So when hackers would find bugs and vulnerabilities in, let's just pick on Microsoft for a minute, in Microsoft's code, they would call up Microsoft in the 90s and they'd say, I just used your code to get into NASA. Like, you need to fix this. And back then, Microsoft was so focused on getting its products out. You know, the Facebook motto of move quickly and break things was very much alive at these tech companies back then, especially when Microsoft missed the boat on the internet and had to try and catch up to Netscape. And there's some interesting history there. But they were just trying to get these products to market so quickly. And there were so many bugs and security problems in the code. And hackers tried to let them know. And Microsoft's response, and a lot of companies' response in those days, was stop probing our products and leave us alone. Don't call back. And what I learned was over that exact same period, defense contractors working on behalf of U.S. intelligence agencies saw real intelligence potential and espionage potential in the bugs that these same hackers were finding. And as they're getting sort of threatened and bopped over the head by the Microsofts of the world, they were getting called up and recruited by these defense contractors and paid as much as $150,000 for one 0 day to basically give it to the U.S. government and not tell a soul about it, so that they could use it for espionage. And so I met with one of the first 0 day brokers who said, you know, originally they were searching for these 0 days on their own, writing the code to exploit them and selling them to other defense contractors or the Pentagon or other law enforcement and intelligence agencies. But then they realized, like, why spend all our time looking for these bugs when hackers all over the world are already looking for them? Why don't we pay them for the raw material, the 0 days? We'll write the code to exploit it and we'll sell that to the US government and it'll save us a ton of time. And so this really interesting market was born where we were sending middlemen. And, you know, by the way, these are secret vulnerabilities in code. We didn't want to leave any trace of these transactions or have these vulnerabilities get out. So, you know, back in those days, some of these payments were made in Western Union payments, but most of them were done in cash. So I would hear these crazy stories from those days where these defense contractors would essentially send middlemen over to Europe. And a lot of the best hackers in those days were in Eastern Europe because they have such a great science and math education program, but they didn't have the same job opportunities we had here. So they'd go over there with a duffel bag full of cash and essentially pay these hackers for their 0 days, bring them back to the Beltway. They would weaponize them and sell them to US government agencies. And that went on for a long time, and it still happens today. Now, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, how on book are these things? Like, how documented were they, or how obscured were they? Everything's obscured by national intelligence agencies, but relative to what you've studied, I'm just curious.
Yeah, so it's very much obscured. You know, in those days, it was like we're talking about cash transactions. So literally no record. And that was really hard to go back and report. And it entailed going and finding one of the first brokers to walk me through this. It entailed finding hackers who were getting paid in those days, and even one of the middlemen who would go back and forth. But then what happened was, you know, back then it was like sign this non-disclosure agreement. But then these programs really became critical to U.S. cyber offensive warfare and espionage programs. So they became classified. So when I went back and tried to find contracts over the last few years, just even, usually what happens is you see the contractor's name and then you see these payments made in the millions of dollars. And it's you know, the description is we paid them for software. And technically that's true. You know, this is just software. These are code to exploit bugs in critical systems and widely used software. But the problem is, like, no one is going to see that contract and think, oh, you know, this is for a 0 day that's going to leave all of us vulnerable. You know, the U.S. government was just paying this company for software. And so I found a lot of these contracts at the Air Force, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the FBI, you know, the usual suspects that would use this for law enforcement. And also some battlefield operations. But I was not able to track down any of these contracts through the NSA or the CIA. And I was told that's because those deals happen through special contract vehicles and are classified. So that's sort of where the trail ended.
So, I mean, what you're describing in terms of like essentially the subcontractors who are sort of finding these vulnerabilities, the contractors who sort of almost like take it from the gray market and sort of almost whitewash it into the system, as it were, and then get it into our national security state. I mean, I've heard stories in terms of arms dealing that is almost identical. To this, where
that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's the cyber arms race. You know, it is the digital equivalent, but it's all done in code, which makes it much harder to trace and much harder for the public to understand the trade-offs.
And it seems to me that you are also it's less explicit in the real world, as it were. And you are the danger of the market that you're creating is exponential, because I can go out and have people, subcontractors, looking for, you know, handguns in Bulgaria that I want to ship to Afghanistan, but I don't have, you know, and I've got to do that. But somewhere there's got to be a factory to make those. If I'm flooding money into this market, all I really need is someone who is a good coder and they need cash, and there's almost like an infinite number of those people throughout the world. So you're actually like, you're building a market that's greater than and less limited than it takes to sort of manufacture handguns.
That's right. And, you know, I quote the broker, the first broker I found, as saying, you know, anyone with $2,000 for a laptop is in this game. And, you know, these, just like you said, these are digital munitions. They really are, in a lot of cases, when you think about the potential to wipe out a hospital's data, wipe out patient records. I mean, we are already seeing these attacks all the time on American hospitals. I just covered an attack on a hospital in Vermont where they wiped out the chemo protocols. So patients who were coming in to get their chemotherapy, they had no way to know what they'd already been given and how to come up with their protocol, and they're turning patients away. So the problem is, like, these threats are no longer theoretical for Americans. Like, every day we are seeing ransomware attacks on our hospitals, on our cities, on companies. We're seeing the Russian attack right now unfold on government IT networks. We are the most vulnerable and targeted country in the planet. Even if we're the most advanced in terms of our cyber offensive capabilities in the world. And so that is the thing I wanted people to understand. We can be really good at hacking. We can keep trying to outsmart the enemy. We can keep thinking we're the only ones who know how to use these zero days to our advantage. But it's really important for people to understand that the trade-off that's made in those programs is at the expense of defense. And every calorie we expend on buying a zero day, exploiting a zero day, hoarding a zero day is a calorie we're taking away from locking down our code, locking down our systems, and making sure Americans are safe.
I want to return to that sort of the dynamic. And really, I guess the one of the crucial questions is it too late to really sort of like, you know, at one point you unleash you create this market and it then becomes self-sustaining, right? Like, you hire enough mercenaries, at one point somebody's going to hire them just to have a war amongst themselves on some
right.
level.
Right.
But let's go to Stuxnet, because this was sort of the archetype example of what is problematic about this. Will you just walk people, because I don't know if people really have as much of an awareness of what Stuxnet was. And certainly, you know, it was 15 years ago almost now. So I think, you know, people have forgotten what this was about, why it was unleashed, and what the problems have been that have sort of rippled through the past 15 years.
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's almost become my party trick. Back when we used to go to parties, be like, you know, have you heard of Stuxnet? And people no. And I was like, okay. Listen to this, get this. So essentially what happened was, you have to really kind of put it in a little bit of context, which was around 2006, 2007, Israel was putting more pressure on the George W. Bush administration to give them the bunker buster bombs that they needed to basically take out Natanz's nuclear facility in Iran. They were really worried about Iran's uranium enrichment facilities. At the same time, the United States was completely bogged down in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We were seeing soldier death counts climb. And the last thing the George W. Bush administration wanted to do in his second term was trigger World War III and get into a war with Iran. So there was a lot of back and forth between his administration and the Israelis. And eventually the NSA came up with what they called their third option, which was coming up with a computer attack, a worm essentially, that could get into the Natanz uranium centrifuges and spin the rotors at speeds. Now, in some cases, they pulled this off. They would spin the rotors at a speed that was too fast, so it would essentially destroy the centrifuge. In other cases, they would slow it down. And they did this brilliantly. They did it over time. They would speed it up, and then they would just sit back for a couple of weeks. Or they would slow it down just to a trickle, and then sit back for a couple of weeks. And all the while, when the engineers at Natanz were looking at their computer screens, everything was showing that it was functioning normally, almost like this Ocean's 11 or Mission Impossible, you know, taking over the screen to show everything being totally normal, but in the background, they're completely destroying their uranium. So we pulled off that attack, and there is, you know, credit where credit is due. That attack was a crazy success. I mean, it kept the Israeli jets on the ground. You know, it headed off World War III, and it set Iran's nuclear ambitions back years, because eventually, when all was said and done, we destroyed about 1,000 of their centrifuges. Some even argue that it brought Iran to the negotiating table when it came time for the Iranian nuclear arms talks. So that all happened. The problem was it got out. So we don't know how, but somehow that worm escaped. And around 2010, security researchers and firms like Symantec all over the world started picking up the Stuxnet code on their client systems, dissecting it, and eventually it came out that this was from an attack on Iran's nuclear facility. When that happened, everything changed. Every government on Earth with any kind of resources at their disposal and any worry about terrorism, activism, you know, adversaries realized what they were missing out on. They saw the potential of code to sow destruction and the espionage potential of code. So since 2010, over the last decade, we have seen a cyber arms race where other governments and really our adversaries, I mean, one of the governments that really kickstarted their offensive cyber programs into action after Stuxnet was Iran. They now boast one of the fifth biggest cyber armies in the world. Now, there's no way to verify that that's actually true, but certainly we are now seeing more attacks on U.S. targets from Iran than almost any other nation state hacking group on Earth. And that is the long tail of Stuxnet. You know, we really showed the world what was possible, and that fueled this market for zero days among countries all over the planet. And one of the things I learned in my book was there is a very healthy supply side market for zero days in Argentina. They, for whatever reason, they didn't have access to the same technologies we had here in the United States. They have a great science and computer technology education there. And the economy wasn't doing so well. And so hackers there learned that they could make quite a lot of money finding zero days, exploiting them, and selling those exploits to governments. So for the book, I went down to Buenos Aires. I went to a hacking convention there. And I met with some of the people who sell these exploits to governments. And I asked one of them, will you only sell these to Western governments, like good Western governments? And the guy just like wanted to smack me. This is like, Nicole, down in Argentina, we don't think of the United States as a good Western government. Last time I checked, the country that bombed another country into oblivion wasn't Iran or China. We will sell to whoever gives us the biggest bag of cash. And that was really a wake-up call for me to understand that the market that the U.S. spawned for zero days has gotten so far beyond our control. This is happening all over the world. And that's why I think right now is a really good time to have the conversation about whether we should be finding and hoarding zero days instead of getting them patched and fixed and rolled out.
that dynamic that you express, right? The essentially us launching an arms race that our own delusion of exceptionalism, I would argue, which allowed it to be like, oh, well, I mean, we have the moral high ground here, of course, or we're considered. I mean, it is doubly problematic because, A, we don't have the moral high ground as far as the vast majority of the world is considers. And B, this is not, again, a situation where the bar to entry is, you know, so high that only a superpower could really manage this. Like you said earlier, all you need is a laptop and a smart person.
Right, exactly.
It's all around the world. And once you lose those two sort of like prohibitions, I guess, or obstacles to getting into that market, we're toast ultimately, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, it's almost like we've carried this Cold War mentality too long. Like we're just up against Russia or one adversary. And as long as we outsmart them by finding the zero days, by exploiting them in clever, stealthy ways, we'll be okay. But that's just not true anymore. We have cyber criminals hitting our hospitals all the time. We have, you know, ransomware attacks have just gone insane. Our elections have been targeted. You know, our critical infrastructure has been targeted. We had a hacker try and get into a water treatment facility and up the levels of lye, the chemical in the water. You know, this is not a theoretical. You know, we may have been the most advanced player in cyber for decades. We are now losing our lead. The gap is closing between what we can do and what these other countries and private citizens can do. And so it's really time to think about how do we start really seriously protecting ourselves.
Part of this too is also just the nature, I would say, of these agencies where it's always offensive, go, 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 as opposed to hold on, we take a step back, maybe stop contracting and hoarding all of these vulnerabilities and potentially just start to build up and fortify our own defenses. I mean, is that kind of the dynamic that you're seeing as well?
Yes. We always asked, can we do this? Sure we can. But we never asked, should we be doing this? And, you know, to be fair to the NSA and the intelligence agencies, they did come up with a process for deciding whether to keep or turn over these vulnerabilities during the George Bush administration. So originally this was boiled down to an acronym that is essentially American exceptionalism in acronym form, which was called NOBUS at the NSA, and it stood for Nobody But Us. If they found a vulnerability or a zero day that they thought only they could be clever enough to exploit, they kept it. If they thought someone else might exploit it, they turned it over to the technology companies. And that sort of calculation became more formalized under Bush and under Obama. The problem is, a couple of years ago, someone, we don't even know who it was, but someone who called themselves the Shadow Brokers, hacked the NSA, dumped their zero-day exploits online. And once we took a look at what the NSA was hoarding, we found that they were hoarding things like a Microsoft Windows vulnerability for 5 years. And once that was dumped online, North Korea picked it up for ransomware attacks. Russia picked it up in an attack on Ukraine that leaked out and hit Pfizer. It hit Merck, where Merck had to basically tap into the CDC's emergency vaccine supplies to supply vaccines that year. It cost FedEx $400 million. It had real blowback for American companies. And imagine if something like that happened right now to Pfizer and to Pfizer's vaccine supply. Like, we really cannot be hoarding a vulnerability in something like Microsoft Windows, which is used by everyone, whether you know it or not, for 5 years, just to preserve our espionage advantage. You need to be thinking about turning those over so we can get them fixed so we don't see that kind of collateral destruction.
I have one more question to sort of build on that, and then I want to come around to sort of like this, the sort of catalog these threats a little bit more. When you say we do this, and when we talk about like the NSA, I'm aware that in having talked to folks who are used to former prosecutors, that on some level, some of what motivates their prosecutions are is an awareness that they're building a market. If we go after these high financiers, individuals, in 5 years, 10 years, I'm going to be defending them. And I'm going to be building a market, and I'm going to be defending these people. I'm going to make a lot of money. And the level of consciousness is, you know, maybe not that explicit, but that's over the course of 4 or 5 years. You're working in there. There's certain incentives. How much of this, how much of what's going on now when we talk about, when we talk about the security apparatus, which is so dominated by contractors anyways, who are actually private actors on some level, how much of it is like, hey, you know, we can find these exploits, you know, these exploits here, and I'm just like, I'm turning it up. I mean, it's the old, you know, sort of like, you know, story about the one lawyer who goes to a small town, has no business until somebody, some other lawyer moves in there, and all of a sudden business is booming. Like, how much of it is a function of all the incentive structures being in there? Like, the more exploits we find, the more I'm going to be needed because I'm the guy who's going to come in and fix it.
It's such a good question. I did not know that about prosecutors. That's disturbing. I'd never heard that level of consciousness before. But listen, I mean, the people who, first of all, let me mention that this market is unregulated. And the reason it's unregulated is because governments aren't regulators in it. They're the clients. They don't have any incentive to regulate a market in code that they themselves benefit from, period. Defense is hard. It is really hard. But the people who have been most outspoken about not setting norms for whether we turn over vulnerabilities, for not setting norms about who that code gets shared with, about whether they can train foreign governments in finding zero-day exploits, are the very people that profit off of these trainings and zero-day sales. And that's the way it's been for the last decade. Those are the people that have been on Twitter the last 24 hours since my book's out, calling the book wrong and saying, you know, this is all a lie. We shouldn't be regulating this. There's a reason, because in the book, I basically out them as mercenaries. I out the fact that they have been training people like Erdogan's military to find zero-day exploits that inevitably Erdogan is going to use on its own people. Right. And we need, you know, Turkey is a NATO ally. Okay. They are an American ally. So is the United Arab Emirates, where I learned former NSA hackers were being recruited to hack Qatar on behalf of the United Arab Emirates. Qatar is an American ally. And who got caught up in that dragnet? Michelle Obama's emails while she was in office communicating with the Shika in Qatar. So there needs to be some discussions about norms for the zero-day market and deciding who are we going to train? Are we going to train governments that we see come to Washington and beat up people on the lawn? You know, are we going to train those people in these capabilities? Are we going to sell them zero-day exploits? Like, that would be a useful discussion to have, you know, and until now, we've really let the people who have the most incentive to see this market unregulated lead these discussions. And that's why I wrote this book. I wanted it to be really accessible to the average American so they can understand what is actually happening here and who the losers are, which is essentially all of us.
All right. So let me ask you this. I mean, there's a couple of questions sort of balled up in this, right? Which is, you know, in part embedded in your title. I mean, there's on one hand, I have this feeling of like, how have we gotten this far in time without it being a much bigger, like a much big, having been a much bigger attack, A, but also simultaneously, like you hear these things like, okay, Oldsmar, Florida. Like I've never even heard of this place. like why there? Why chemo in Vermont? Like, what, like, what is going, like, is there a sense amongst these people, like, if we do a little hit there and there, like, I'm going to rob a couple of small community banks, and that way the FBI doesn't come after me. Like, I'm just trying to come up with some type of metaphor. But if I go after Fort Knox, then I'm in big trouble. Like,
right.
What's going on? Is it that coordinated? Or is it just like, are there people just sort of like testing vulnerabilities, or is there like five different stories that are happening simultaneously? And some of it is, you know, we're just lucky? Or, I mean, what is the dynamic here at play in terms of the threat as its potential and as it's being carried out?
So these are really targets of opportunity. I mean, just mechanically, let me just say what actually happens here in the case of the Vermont hospital, for instance. Cyber criminals, many of them in Eastern Europe, some in Russia, will scan around to look for open ports, open systems, people who haven't plugged up their software, who are using old software. And they'll scan around, and when they find one, they'll take a foothold into that system. Then they'll sell that foothold to other cyber criminals. There's a very sophisticated Eastern European, Russian economy for access to vulnerable systems. So they'll sell their access to another actor. And maybe this other actor is a ransomware group. And they'll pay a subscription fee, essentially, to drop ransomware into these vulnerable systems that this other group is maintaining a foothold into. And so it's very much a target of opportunity. It's just scanning the world, seeing who's vulnerable, locking them up with ransomware, demanding a ransom in millions of dollars, and then taking that money and continuing on their merry way. Now, in the case of the water treatment facility in Oldsmar, Florida, it's a little bit different. You're right. I had never heard of Oldsmar, Florida. This is like population 15,000, you know, just outside Tampa. But, you know, this was on Friday, right before Super Bowl weekend in Tampa, like a little bit terrifying in terms of timing. And there we don't know how they got in. But, you know, if I had to guess, it would probably be a phishing attack, like an email and then the water treatment facility didn't have two-factor authentication turned on, which would have kept someone from another, you know, strange device logging into their networks. So the reason Oldsmar is because these smaller critical infrastructure operators, which in the United States are mostly private companies, don't have the security resources or budgets of a PG&E, let's say. And so because they're under-resourced, they often allow contractors to remote into their systems from afar to make sure everything's going smoothly or troubleshoot a problem if there is one. And that access becomes very opportunistic for a cyber criminal who wants to, in that case, exact destruction. And what they did was, thank God, there was an engineer sitting at his computer system on Friday. He saw his mouse, his cursor, move around on his screen, didn't think anything of it because supervisors remote into these systems all the time. And then 5.5 hours later, saw that same cursor go into the functions that control the chemical levels in the drinking supply, moved up the amount of lye, L-Y-E, from 100 parts per million to 11,000 parts per million. If that had made its way into the drinking supply, those 15,000 people would be at the hospital. And you know what's happening at hospitals right now because of COVID. That could have been a really deadly attack. Fortunately, some guy just happened to be watching his computer screen at that very moment. Fortunately, it takes 24 hours to 36 hours for that water, contaminated water, to make its way to the tap. So they say that they have sensors along the way that would have caught this. And maybe, thank God, you know, but there are plenty of smaller critical infrastructure operators that don't have those sensors set up, that don't have someone sitting at their screen. And those become very ripe targets for anyone with, you know, an axe to grind.
So, I mean, that's like really an attempted mass murder. I mean, there's really no other way to really describe that. I mean, I guess, because, you know, the person.
I mean, I have a hard time because what it really is, to be honest, is a terrorist attack. It's an attempt at a terrorist attack. You know, if someone was doing this, someone went to your local reservoir and poured poison in, and that made its way and killed and sickened tons of people, we would call that terrorism, right? But because these things are done with code, and because a lot of the people who work with these systems and work on security are scared of scaring the bejesus out of all of us, they don't call it a terrorist attack. And I do think that's important. Don't overhype the threat, but also don't underhype it. Because this thing happened on Friday, and it was a very close call, and we've had a lot of close calls.
I guess I you know, when we talk about terrorism, you know, I think like part of that is a function of like what is the intent, like what is the purpose, right? And all we know now is like, you know, if some you know, someone who's a you know, just a a bad person who's like, I like this, you know, an arsonist, essentially. I'm going to pour this into the reservoir for just because I like the idea that I'm hurting people. I mean, that I guess that's the, I'm a little bit concerned about that designation only because of the implications of it, because at the end of the day, we need the security. We need it to protect against people who have a political ideology that they may be doing these things, or that may just be like, I like to see people suffer, you know, like the whatever it is. But I guess in the final analysis, like, what is the federal response to something like this when you're talking about, you know, a 15,000 person town in Florida? Like, is this just something we're just going to have to live with on some level? Or are we dealing with big, sophisticated players? Are we dealing with just like opportunistic people?
So in that case, if I had to guess, I'm going to guess it's probably some disgruntled person somewhere, not a nation state. But it's worth remembering that 7 years ago, we caught an Iranian hacker inside a dam mucking around with the controls that control the locks to the dam. Now, that was an interesting story, actually, because it was the Bowman Avenue Dam in New York, just, you know, 30 miles outside Manhattan. But when the White House first learned that there was an Iranian hacker poking these dam systems and they heard the word Bowman Dam, they thought it was the Arthur Bowman Dam in Oregon, which if they had unleashed the locks there would have been like a cyber tsunami. So, you know, but it turns out the Bowman Avenue Dam in New York like holds back a tiny babbling brook and no one lives right under it, and et cetera. So anyway, just pointing that out. I think that it doesn't really matter on some level who the actors are, because whether it's a teenager in his basement or it's Iran or it's Russia, like they all have these capabilities, right? So it's almost like just start looking at it as a matter of defense. Like, we just don't want a bored teenager or Russia or Iran in our dam locks, in our water treatment facilities. And these threats are real now. They are happening. They are happening every week. And so it's time to ask ourselves, do we really need to have the locks of our major dams remotely accessible on the internet? Do we really need to have the chemical levels and controls at a water treatment facility accessible through the internet? You know, no, we probably don't need to be doing that. And that's going to cost money. It means that they can't have engineers remote in from hundreds of miles away. They need someone sitting there on premises watching these things. And even then, you know, even someone on premises in an air gap system disconnected from the internet, we know that those can be vulnerable too, because that's what we did with Stuxnet. You know, we don't know what happened, but we know that that was an air gap system that wasn't on the internet, but we know someone brought in a USB stick. But it's a lot harder to bring in a USB stick or get a spy to bring in a USB stick than it is to remote in through software.
Well, Nicole Porloff, the book is This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. Thanks so much. Fascinating and sort of terrifying. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Sorry I was upside down there for a minute.
No worries. All right, going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in a minute. We just have a couple of seconds left, but you know, it occurs to me, one of the problems that we have with technology, I imagine this is worldwide, but certainly in this country, is you've got these places that are trying to save a lot of money we have remote engineers as opposed to coming in. Or instead of having moderators for our YouTube videos, we have algorithms. This is all about profits. Mm-hmm. It's all about, profits for a private contractor coming in and helping with your water system, your treatment plant. And to a certain extent, at one point, we're going to have to make the determination that we can't afford this because it's too dangerous. Scary stuff. We will be back tomorrow talking more about impeachment and voting that's happening or not happening across the country because Republicans are shutting down the access to the ballot. We'll see you then. For those of you sticking around, we're going to talk more impeachment in the rest of the show. This is where we're going to head into the fun half, as you know, Emma.
Yes.
You're aware of that.
I just got, actually, I don't know if I should say this. I just got a text from a friend saying, Bruce Castor, do you recognize that name?
Bruce Castor.
I went to college with his son.
Oh, you did? Well, there you go.
Third.
EC3, nice.
Oh, Bruce Castor the third. Wow. I mean, were you good friends with him? No.
What frat was he in?
Zeta Psi.
I don't even know what that means. I honestly don't. We didn't have frats at my college, so I have no idea what that means.
I don't even know if I should said that. Yeah. I crossed paths with him, but I didn't know him well.
Well, this is fun half stuff.
I remember salmon pants being worn. That's really about it.
I don't know what that means either. I missed all of this. I had no idea of any of it. Salmon pants or Zeta Kappa or whatever. None of that. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that can make the show possible. You become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And you will support this program. Also, don't forget AM Quickie. Check it out. 6-7 minutes in the morning. Headline news happens very early. I know that because Dorsey called me at 6:30 in the morning. I forgot to send the file. So he got it out the door. Today on the Nomi Key Show, you can find that at youtube.com/thenomikeyshow or twitch.tv/the_nomikey_show. David Korn and Deborah Levitt will be on 3 p.m. Check that out. Also, don't forget the Antifada, twitch.tv/theantifada. Jamie's been on vacation, but I think she's back tomorrow. So check that out. Also, Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekian media platform, as it were?
Yeah, so our interview with Grace Blakely on Left Reckoning is going to be next week. Tomorrow night, we're going to have Ben Burgess on for his return. We're going to get into logic of the left with him and some other stuff. So Ben Burgess, me, David, tomorrow night, 8:00 Eastern time on Left Reckoning's YouTube channel.
I think I'm going on Ben's podcast next Monday.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I mean, not next Monday, the Monday after that.
I was going to say, President's Day.
Yeah, no. I'm
Matt, you'll be happy to know that I told Saul. Saul was playing a, he's got, I don't know, it's like roadblocks and this and that. And there is a, he's flying around on a dragon. And he's flying around on a dragon. He's saying, and I said, like, where are you going? He goes, I'm just flying around. It's pretty cool. And I said, you know, Matt, who works on my show, he'll fly around in like a fake real airplane and look at like the ground of like, you know, maps. You can see places. And I said, isn't that cool? And he's like, no.
I mean, dragons are a little bit cooler than, you know, Cessnas, but.
Yep. Folks, Hunt-A-Killer is the murder mystery subscription box that's the most exciting date night you can do at home. Hunt-A-Killer brings people together by challenging them to decode ciphers, examine clues, and solve puzzles. It's like an escape room delivered right to your door. Right now, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority and use promo code MAJORITY for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure to use the code MAJORITY for a 20% discount. Folks, we'll see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a man.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Fucking reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are black.
Out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.